We're going to be looking at Judges chapter 8, starting in verse 1 through verse 17. Then the people of Ephraim asked Gideon, "Why have you treated us this way? Why didn't you send us out? Why didn't you send for us when you first went out to fight the Midianites?" And they argued heatedly with Gideon. But Gideon replied, "What have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't even the leftover grapes of Ephraim's harvest better than the entire crop of my little clan of Abiezer? God gave you victory over Oreb and Zeb, the commanders of the Midianite army. What have I accomplished compared to that?" When the men of Ephraim heard Gideon's answer, their anger subsided. Gideon then crossed the Jordan River with his 300 men, and though exhausted, they continued to chase the enemy. When they reached Succoth, Gideon asked the leaders of the town, "Please give my warriors some food. They are very tired. I am chasing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." But the officials of Succoth replied, "Catch Zeba and Zalmunna first, and then we will feed your army." So Gideon said, "After the Lord gives me victory over Zeba and Zalmunna, I will return and tear your flesh with the thorns and briars from the wilderness." From there, Gideon went up to Peniel and asked again for food, but he got the same answer. So he said to the people of Peniel, "After I return in victory, I will tear down this tower." By this time, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with about 15,000 warriors, all that remained of the allied armies of the east, for 120,000 had already been killed. Gideon circled around by the caravan route east of Nobah and Jogbea, taking the Midianite army by surprise. Zeba and Zalmunna, the two Midianite kings, fled, but Gideon chased them down and captured all their warriors. After this, Gideon returned from the battle by the way of Harez Pass. There he captured a young man from Succoth and demanded that he write down the names of all the 77 officials and elders in the town. Gideon then returned to Succoth and said to the leaders, "Here are Zeba and Zalmunna. When we were here before, you taunted me, saying, 'Catch Zeba and Zalmunna first, and then we will feed your exhausted army.' Then Gideon took the elders of the town and taught them a lesson, punishing them with the thorns and briars from the wilderness. He also tore down the tower of Peniel and killed all the men in the town."
So Judges chapter 8, verse 1 starts out with, says, "Then the people of Ephraim asked Gideon, 'Why have you treated us this way? Why didn't you send for us when you first went out to fight the Midianites?' They argued heatedly with Gideon, but Gideon replied, 'What have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't even the leftover grapes from Ephraim's harvest better than the entire crop of my little clan of Abiezer? God gave you victory over Oreb and Zeb, the commanders of the Midianite army. What have I accomplished compared to that?' When the men of Ephraim heard Gideon's answer, their anger subsided." So we need a little bit of context here. Remember, in chapter 6 and 7, God calls Gideon. He says, "I'm going to let you be the leader that leads us out of our bondage to the Midianites into freedom." And so Gideon takes these brave steps forward. The first thing he does is he smashes the old idols, the idols of Baal. It's literally in the middle of the night, and he takes that idol and he pushes it over, it breaks. Basically, they destroy the idol worship that was happening in Israel at the time. God says, "The next step is for you to muster an army. I'm going to have you fight against the Midianites. You're going to take them by force." So Gideon does that, gathers like 30,000 people, goes through this whole series of events where God tells him, "That's too many people. You did a good job, but that's too many, so we need to filter down your army." And basically, they filter it down to about 300 people. Now, mind you, they're fighting against 100,000 enemies, 100,000 Midianites. Okay, and so through a series of events, God causes confusion in the Midianite army. Gideon is courageous throughout all of this. He leads the 300 men into battle. Midianites essentially destroy themselves, and then they start running away. Okay, there's about 15,000 of them left at this point in time, and where we pick it up in chapter 8, Gideon's pursuing them with the 300 men. Okay, so they're following after him. They're going to finish the battle here. Now, along the way, you hear from this group of guys called the Ephraimites. Okay, they're upset with Gideon. They say, "Why didn't you call us? Why didn't you ask us to come help fight when it all began?" And there's a good reason for that. Okay, where the battle was beginning, Gideon asked the three nearest tribes of Israel to come join him in battle. Kind of the ones that could get there the quickest. Okay, and the Ephraimites, they actually weren't part of that group. They're further south, and so he asked, I think it's the tribe of Manasseh and Asher and Naphtali, and they all gather together. The Ephraimites are just kind of out of the picture. They're further down south. As things unfurl, as he gets the Midianite army on the run, the enemies, then Gideon sends out messengers to Ephraim, to these guys, and says, come help. We got them on the run. Come help us finish them off. And they do exactly that. That's how chapter 7 ends. The people of the tribe of Ephraim, they come out. They capture the princes of Midian. They take care of their business. And they do a really good job, but that's not enough for them. So they come out and fight, and they do their work, and they see Gideon on the road, and they say, what the heck, man? Why didn't you ask us sooner? We could have done more damage. We could have come out and been more helpful sooner. And we don't really know why they're upset here. We only know that they stop to complain while Gideon's kind of in the heat of battle. They stop him, cause him to distract his attention to them, to complain to him, like, hey, you should have asked us sooner. You could have done better that way. Okay? And so they're upset. I don't know why they complained per se. Maybe they felt left out. You know, I just wanted to be asked, you know. I don't know if maybe they just wanted to fight. Some people are like that, always ready to fight. I don't know if they just wanted to complain. Maybe they just wanted to armchair quarterback Gideon here. Okay? Maybe they wanted to be helpful. And we'll give them the benefit of the doubt here, because Gideon certainly does. His response to them is to say, whoa, guys, like, calm down. Okay, you've done a great job. What have I done compared to you? I'm still chasing my enemy. I haven't caught him yet. I'm still working on my thing. You guys already took care of what you needed to do. And that calms them down. Okay, this is this gracious response from Gideon. He's diplomatic. Some would say that he used flattery to try and calm their anger, and it worked. The Bible speaks of this. A soft response calms anger. It's in the Proverbs. So he gives this gracious response, and good for him. Okay, Gideon's this leader that's thrust onto the position of, you know, importance. The spotlight is on him. He's taken on the full responsibility for this. And in process, even when he's tired, even when he's in the middle of battle, he gives this gracious response. Good for him. Okay, he calms him down. He continues on to do the work that he's tasked with. Now, we're not going to move past this without talking about complaining. Because this is an uncomfortable thing that they did to him. They stop him in the middle of battle to question why he did it the way that he did. And this is a common response. This is how people work. Human beings have a hard time with authority. Human beings, at their very nature, their sinful nature, are prideful and tend to think that they know better of how to do something than that guy or than that gal. Or certainly we know better how to do things at work than our bosses know, don't we? It's like the universal human attribute. We know how to do it better than our bosses do it. We have a problem with authority, and it's our sinful nature rebelling against God ultimately, but rebelling against the people who have some authority and leadership in our lives. And so complaining is what happens. Complaining is what comes out. That's what these guys do. They complain about how and why Gideon did it. They also complain without knowing all the information. Did you catch that part? Okay, they're joining the battle late. They don't know how things started. That doesn't stop them from questioning why he did it the way that he did. This is also how things go, isn't it? Even without all the information, we tend to complain about how somebody else chose to do something the way they did. We question their motive. We can question their decision. People have a problem with authority. And even being ignorant, even being, you know, without all of the information, we'll question why the leaders did it the way that they did. It's pride. It's our own arrogance. It's our own decision that we know better than somebody else. Okay, they must have a bad motive. They must not know what they're doing. And it comes out real easy, doesn't it? It's our own flesh. It comes out real easy to complain. It happens all the time in stupid things like sports, sitting at home watching TV. Why did the coach go for it on 4th-and-1? No way he was going to make it. Okay, lost the game for the team. It happens in battle. You can see what's happening here. Why didn't you invite us? It happens in church. Why are they doing things the way they're doing? This happens even in the members of a church about their very own leaders. I hear this from time to time, and you know, forgive me if I'm speaking of you. I'm not thinking of anybody in particular, but there's this way that people says things that sort of creates this us and them mentality. Instead of saying, we, I'm a member of this church, I'm part of what's happening here, it's like, why do they always make us do it that way? But why did they decide to do it that way instead of why did we decide to do it this way? And I'll give you a hard time every time. I mean, if I've had this conversation with you, okay, me and Sasha joke about it behind the scenes. We tend to think we know better than our leaders, even if we don't have all the information. We also tend to complain about leaders and what they're doing in the heat of battle. Okay, and this one's tough. So sometimes when emotions run high, when you're in the middle of the conversation, you want to question things, you want to have your say. But there's a better way. There's a better time. Okay, these guys certainly picked the wrong time to question Gideon. Okay, we talk about this when we go on mission as a church. The team prepares, they go through training, kind of go through the expectations, the planning, talk about how trips usually go. One of the things that comes up always is there may not be an opportunity to explain what's happening in the moment, but just ask later at a better time, and we can do that. Okay, even if it's something that you don't understand, even if it's something that makes you fearful, even if it's something that you're questioning, what the heck, later on is possibly the better time. This isn't to say you don't reach and yell to somebody when they're stepping out in front of a bus in Cebu City. You do that, Daphne, wherever you are. Okay, pull Brittany back. It's not to say you don't speak up in a moment of emergency, but not every time, not every moment, not every instance is the right time to voice your opinion, nitpick at what's wrong or what you see is wrong about the circumstance. But this is human nature. We like to complain. Ephraimites certainly do this here to Gideon. They pick a bad time. He does a great job. He's being a good leader here. He's redirecting and getting back to the battle plan. So let's move forward, starting in verse 4. Gideon then crossed the Jordan River with 300 men, and though exhausted, they continued to chase the enemy. When they reached Succoth, Gideon asked the leaders of the town, "Please give my warriors some food. They are very tired, and I am chasing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." But the officials of Succoth replied, "Catch Zeba and Zalmunna first, and then we will feed your army." So Gideon, Gideon said, "After the Lord gives me victory over Zeba and Zalmunna, I will return and tear your flesh with thorns and briars from the wilderness." From there, Gideon went up to Peniel and again asked for some food, and he got the same answer. So he said to the people of Peniel, "After I return in victory, I will tear down this tower." Things start to turn worse for him. He gets some new enemies here along the way. These are supposed to be people to help him. These are Israelites. He's chasing his enemy, and he just simply asks for food. He doesn't even ask him to join the battle. He says, "Give me some bread. Give my men some bread. They're hungry." And these people refuse to step in and help. And now I think what's happening is these people don't want to choose a side. Okay, they're not certain that Gideon's going to win this battle yet. And if they choose to help him, they might receive punishment later. For now, they're neutral. Okay, they're out of the fray. They're not involved directly in the fight. And so whichever side it goes to, they won't be punished, is what they're thinking. Okay, that's not what ends up happening. But they refuse to choose a side. They refuse to help their brother, Gideon, and his friends. And this makes Gideon angry. Okay, maybe he's just really hungry and needs a snack. Maybe he feels alone and unappreciated. Maybe he's used up all his patience already. Okay, he used it previously on the previous batch of people questioning him. But all this is to say that leadership is really difficult. It's hard. You got the weight, the responsibility. You're the one that bears the weight and responsibility. And you're dealing with people who aren't always very appreciative of what you're doing, aren't always very supportive of what you're doing. Being a leader is hard. Okay, so Gideon here, he's in this thankless position. In the heat of battle, people, they can be thankless. They question your motives, second guess all your decisions, insist they know a better way, refuse to commit to be involved. They can make you prove yourself again and again. It's hard when you're dealing with that kind of support, that is. Now, the Bible comes along and gives us a totally different dynamic for how we should see leaders, how we should follow leaders, how we should support leaders. Okay, turn to Hebrews chapter 13 for just a second. And I can understand Gideon's frustration here, to be honest. Wouldn't you be frustrated too? These guys won't help him. Something simple. He's asking kind of bare minimum of them. I think I can understand his frustration. Hebrews chapter 13 comes along. How should we support our leaders? How should we feel and act toward our leaders? What kind of attitude should we have? Look at verse 17. It says, "Obey your spiritual leaders and do what they say. Their work is to watch over your souls, and they are accountable to God. Give them reason to do this with joy and not with sorrow. That would certainly not be for your benefit." Now, if you're going to follow God, if you're going to put yourself under His authority, one of the actions that ends up happening is you put yourself under the authority of a spiritual leader. God's given us the church. In the church, God's given us gifts of prophets and apostles, pastors and teachers. It's Ephesians chapter 4. And so you put yourself under the spiritual authority of somebody in God's local kingdom that we call a church, an outpost of that kingdom in the church. Part of what you're doing is you're submitting to God and you're submitting to the local authority that He's placed over you in that church. Okay? If you're going to do this, if you're going to humble yourself before God, it's going to include humbling yourself before people. And the passage here in Hebrews is the exact opposite of how the world sees leaders. Okay, the world says cast doubt toward their motives. Question whether they're competent or capable. Question their decisions. Second guess them. Complain about them online. Watch YouTube videos of people complaining about them online so you can find some new friends who agree with you. And this comes along and says the exact opposite. Support your leaders. Submit to them. Honor them. Make their job a joy. Hey, don't make it a trouble, a struggle. That wouldn't be any of any benefit toward you. Okay? The attitude God wants us to have is if we're submitting to Him, it will include submitting to spiritual leaders here on earth. Okay? And that's representative of how we're submitting to Him. This is not to say you never, ever have a conversation with a leader about what you think. But certainly this is to cast grace toward them, patience toward them, support of them. Gideon's getting none of that here. He's the one that stepped forward. He's the one hearing from the Lord on what to do. And these guys didn't give him the benefit of the doubt. They didn't give him the support that I think God would ask of each of us. Okay. If we're going to follow God, we're going to have to deal with our problem with authority. Part of the practical way we deal with that, our problem with authority to God Himself, is to put ourselves in under authority in the local church. Now, secondly, I want to just cover this briefly. This dynamic of what's happening between Gideon and the first batch of people, okay, and Gideon and the second batch of people, this is actually a really realistic timeline, a realistic scenario that's happened. First group, Gideon's response is their leader. He's gracious, he's patient, he's gentle, he's kind. Okay, he puts up with their questioning, and he figures out the situation in a kind way. Second scenario, not so much. Okay, there's wrath and punishment. We'll read about that here in a minute. These are the two extremes of what can happen, what tends to happen. Not every instance is going to be puppies and rainbows and flowers. Not every instance is going to be grace. Sometimes there's going to be punishment and discipline and wrath. When dealing with somebody who's leading you, not every time they're going to understand your rebellion and do it graciously. Sometimes they're going to actually have to punish you so you'll back down. They'll have to humble you with a hard stance. Okay? Not every time but sometimes. And this is a really realistic scenario. You'll get both. Okay? Think about Jesus for a second. Was Jesus both? Just think of how he interacted with people throughout the gospel. Sometimes he was gracious and kind, Gideon part one here. Sometimes he was wrathful, even angry, and there was punishment involved, Gideon part two. Okay, there's both. Now, Gideon crosses a line here. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we don't get to decide which of these extremes our leaders take. And there's middle answers too, probably a sliding scale in the middle of combination of things. We don't get to decide that. Again, if we're going to judge our leaders and how they respond and how they interact with us, they're not really our leaders, are they? We're kind of putting ourselves above them. We're the one that's grading their performance. We're the one judging how they're doing, what they're doing. We don't get to do that. Not if you're going to be humble. Not if you're actually going to submit to them. Not if you're actually going to follow God's leading through them. We don't get to decide. The leader, they don't get to decide either. Did you notice in the Hebrews 13 passage, it says they give account to God, your spiritual leaders? If that's true, and it is, then your leaders are going to be yielding to God's lead on this. They should be. They're trying to. Both sides, leader and follower, I guess, in this case, it's going to be imperfect. This is where love comes into play. This is where grace comes into play. We get some good example from Gideon here, and we get a little bit of a bad example, which we'll get to now. Yeah, we don't get to decide these things. Just think about how you respond, you know, in the authority of your life, whether it's spiritual authority, maybe it's your work authority, maybe it's your family authority, boss, teacher, mother, father, pastor, whatever other ones there are. How do you deal with them? Are you constantly judging them? Are you constantly rebelling against them? Are you yielding to them? Okay. Now let's go on. Pick it up in verse 10. By this time, Ziba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with 15,000 warriors. And all that remained of the allied armies to the east, for 120,000 had already been killed. Gideon circled around by the caravan route east of Nobah and that place, taking the Midianite army by surprise. Ziba and Zalmunna, the two Midianite kings, fled. But Gideon chased them down and captured all of their warriors. After this, Gideon returned from the battle by way of the Heres Pass. There he captured a young man from Succoth and demanded that he write down the names of all 77 officials and the elders in the town. Gideon then returned to Succoth and said to the leaders, "Here are Ziba and Zalmunna. When we were here before, you taunted me, saying, 'Catch them first, then we will feed your exhausted army.'" Then Gideon took the elders of the town and taught them a lesson, punishing them with thorns and briars from the wilderness. He also tore down the tower of Peniel and killed all the men in that town. Then Gideon asked Ziba and Zalmunna, "The men you killed at Tabor, what were they like?" "Like you," they replied. "They had the look of a king's son." "They were my brothers, the sons of my own mother," Gideon exclaimed. "As surely as the Lord lives, I wouldn't kill you if you hadn't killed them." Turning to Jether, his oldest son, he said, "Kill him. Kill them." But Jether did not draw his sword, for he was only a boy, and he was afraid. Then Ziba and Zalmunna said to Gideon, "Be a man, kill us yourself." So Gideon killed them both and took the royal ornaments from the necks of their camels. Okay, so the battle ends. And at this point in time, the story is kind of shifting. It's barely even about the battle anymore. It's over. Gideon finishes the job. He captures the kings. And then it moves on to his personal rampage that he seems to be going on here. Okay, and so the battle finishes. That's done. Now we're just kind of getting this resolution to the story. Now, by the way, most of the stories in the book of Judges, they sort of say this person rose up into power, into sort of this hero role, this leader role. He rescues Israel from their enemies. And then there's peace in the land after that for a while. This story of Gideon's rare in that we kind of get this resolution after the fact of all these things that are happening, and it's a different finish to the repeated pattern of the story. And so we get more details here, and they're going to focus on Gideon. But he gets his revenge. Okay, that's the main point. He captures the kings of Midian. Okay, why does he have his youngest son, or why does he try to have his youngest son kill them? Apparently it's to embarrass them or something. He's just a boy. He's too young. He doesn't really want to do it. So then they taunt him, and he kills him himself. You know, what an ending. If you guys want to make up some things to say about that, you can tell me later. The other part is that he goes back to the towns of the people that refused to help them, and he does exactly what he said he was going to do earlier. So he goes back to Succoth. The first thing he does is he finds a young boy. He tells him to write down the list of 77 names and all the elders. Think of how long that took. You ever written out a list of 77 names? Maybe some of you that got married recently, you're writing a guest list or something like that. This is a premeditated action. He's fuming. He's certainly boiling over as far as his anger is Gideon. He gets him to write down the name. He gets the name, then he goes back to the town. And all it says is he punishes them with briars from the wilderness. I don't have any idea what this means. Okay? Apparently, he roughed them up a little bit. That's the best I can think. Some commentators say he probably killed them. But there's no guarantee. It doesn't say that. They just assume. Well, the second batch of guys, the guys from Penuel, they're still hiding up in their tower. And he literally goes and knocks the tower down, killing them all. It's sort of this escalating rampage. Okay, he's Godzilla, he's in the city, and he's just knocking down buildings and eating people. Okay, so Gideon gets his revenge. His anger is burning hotter and hotter, and the main thing we need to know here is this is a turning point for him. Okay, up until now, he's been leading the fight, he's been leading the battle, he's doing good. Good response first, angry response second. But what is left out of this part of the story as he's making decisions is God. Okay, previously God had guided him into what he should do, and he obeyed. He was great. He was brave. He was specific. He obeyed to the full. And here now, in his anger, in his own maybe overconfidence, you might say, or maybe in his own hurt ego for the people who didn't recognize his bravery and come to support him, he's starting to make his own decisions about what needs to happen next. Okay, he starts to enforce his own will. Okay, and this is where he starts to go wrong. Now, people are mixed on Gideon. Is this the point at which he goes off the rails and we need to be highly critical of him? Or can we find some sense of, no, maybe it wasn't all that bad? And people are split on this. Some people will be highly critical, some will be less critical. But let's read on, where we'll talk a little bit about his hypocrisy, about this strange ephod that he makes. Pick it up in verse 22. Then the Israelites said to Gideon, "Be our ruler. You and your son and your grandson will be our rulers, for you have rescued us from Midian." But Gideon replied, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son. The Lord will rule over you. However, I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from the plunder you collected from your fallen enemies." And the enemies were Ishmaelites who wore gold earrings. "Gladly," they replied. They spread out a cloak, and each one threw a gold earring he had gathered from the plunder. The weight of the gold earring was 43 pounds, not including the royal ornaments and the pendants, the purple clothing worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains around the necks of the camels. Gideon made a sacred ephod from the gold and put it in Ophrah, his hometown. But soon all the Israelites prostituted themselves by worshiping it, and it became a trap for Gideon and his family. That is the story of how the people of Israel defeated Midian, which never recovered. Throughout the rest of Gideon's lifetime, about 40 years, there was peace in the land. All right, so the battle is over. Gideon led the people to victory, and they want to make him their king. Okay, that's what they're asking. They say, "You'll be our king, and then your son will be the next king, and then your grandson after that." And Gideon quickly diminishes that. He says, "No, I will not do that." He says, the Lord will be your king. This is a great response. He's still on track here. He still has the right priority. Okay, God is the ruler. Gideon was used by him as his servant, and he's still in a good spot. No, I will not be your king. That's not what God is asking. Okay, but then he goes on to basically do some actions as a king. Basically do the same acts that a king would do. He wants them to give him some of the spoils of war. Okay, and this is the act of a king. He says, give me the gold earrings you collected from the Ishmaelites. Okay, they do so along with some other stuff. They say there's enough gold where it's like 40-some pounds or more. And he does something really, really strange with it. He makes a golden ephod. Okay, an ephod is the garment of a priest. It is the garment of, you know, the priests in the Old Testament that they would wear. So Aaron, Moses' brother, the high priest, and so on. There's sort of some instructions from God to make these ephods. It's a cloak. It's an overcoat. I'd like to think of it more as a cape, but that's not true. It just goes over. It's like a smock. He makes this ephod out of gold, and it weighs 50 pounds, and so it's not for him to wear. It's probably just to set in a glass case, you know, in the middle of a quiet room, like a museum. He makes an ephod out of it. Now, he didn't make a golden calf, so that's maybe some success there. It's not like in Exodus where Moses goes up to the mountain and his brother and the people down there, they make a calf. But it's not dissimilar from that. Okay, so he makes this ephod. I like to think of this as Gideon's big mistake. What was he doing here? Well, some people would say he wanted not to be their king. He was serious about that, but he wanted to be their priest. And this was representative of that. He wanted to be the one to mediate between them and God. He truly wanted God to rule over them all, and yet he was going to be the one to mediate. God was speaking to him. He had led the people through battle. He would now be their priest. He sets it up in his own hometown, it says. He apparently wants people to come there to see it, come consult him for what God would say. Again, this is Gideon's big mistake. This is not what God's asking him to do, okay? If it was, it would have said it here in the text. Not what God's asking him to do. This is Gideon taking matters into his own hands. In some sense, this is probably him wanting a little bit of attention for all the good that he had done. Come back and remember the great victory we had. Come and see this awesome gold thing that I made. Okay. So he makes this ephod. The worst part about this is it causes the Israelites to commit idolatry with it. It says they prostitute themselves. Some of your translations say they whore after it. Okay, this is like committing spiritual adultery against God. If you're married, you have a spouse, you're intended to have sexual relations with your spouse. The union between you and them, it makes you one. God says that's lifelong, and the intent there is that you be faithful to them until you or them die or both. Spiritual adultery is you're supposed to be faithful in union with God. Committing spiritual adultery means you worship a different god, an idol, a false god, perhaps something that's not a god, but you treat it like one. The worst part about all this is the people are led into this by Gideon's action. He makes this ephod. They come after it. It becomes a barrier between them and God. They come to worship his ephod. Okay. Some sense, they might even be worshiping him, what he did, the greatness of Gideon, you know. But it becomes a problem. It leads the people astray. We'll come back to this as we get to the end of the story. But it also says it becomes a snare to Gideon and his own family. Now, it doesn't give commentary on how this works. Perhaps he had gained so much popularity that he couldn't undo his action here. He created this thing, it brought people's attention to him, and he couldn't get them back to give their attention to God. Or perhaps he was drawing so much attention that he stopped worshiping God himself. Okay, we don't know the answer. It doesn't say. We'll come back to this idea in a minute. For now, let's talk about some modern-day ephods. Hey, there's ways that we repeat this process. There's ways that Christians, us, that we actually do the same thing in our own lives. We create something that becomes the focus of our faith, that actually ends up getting in the way of us having a strong relationship with God, where we're hearing from Him, we're loving Him, and we're serving Him. These could be things like the ministry that we're part of, a cause, you know, volunteer cause that we get into. This could be our role in the church, certain activities that we really get into. And these things do two things. For one, they deceive us. We make our Christianity about the things that we do, not about God and loving Him and following Him. The deceives us, but it also causes other people to look at us and say, that's what a Christian looks like. That must be what it means to follow God. I need to get myself involved in this activity, or I need to find one of my own that's equally impressive, that's equally meaningful. We can turn things in our life into this golden idol that actually will distract us from worshiping God. I don't believe the people here were only worshiping this golden creation of Gideon. I think they were doing both, trying to worship God, but also giving too much attention to this thing. And it was a mixed worship. We can do that in our own lives. We can create these things for ourselves. Start out with the best of intentions. Have every intention to do this for God, to love Him and serve Him. But then it gets flipped in its priority. It gets flipped in our attention, in our focus, in our love. And we start to love what we do for God more than Him, God Himself. So we can do this in our own lives. We were in Kansas City recently. We went to a conference down there. We were talking to a guy who had been a missionary in China. Okay, and we'll call him Phil, because that was his name. So Phil, he was in China for 10 years. Okay, and he's telling all these stories about ministry and life over there, missions. He's telling stories about himself, about his testimony of how he became a Christian. He's telling stories about just important parts of his life. And it was great hearing all this. One of the things he said, there came a point in his life where the biggest idol in his life was ministry. The biggest barrier to him loving God and connecting with God was his role as a pastor and a missionary. He said the only time he found himself drawing close to God is when he needed to accomplish something in his job, his pastor role, his missions role. He created this golden object. And honestly, people come and see this. It's awesome. Look at me minister. Look at me preach. Look at me missionary. And he said it was just a crushing, heart-wrenching realization. He said it was like one of those moments. Remember the story in the Old Testament where David commits adultery and his friend Nathan shows up and he tells this story about, okay, there's this man, he stole a sheep and blah, blah, blah. And then he says, you're the man. It was that. That's what Phil went through. He said some guy basically painted this scenario and kind of the reveal was, Phil, isn't that kind of you right now? That's hard, but it's needed. If we've created these golden objects in our lives where these things are more important than God Himself, we've done what Gideon did here. We can lead ourselves off course. We can lead others astray. And we need to be careful of that. We can repent of it, though. I wish the story said, and Gideon smashed the idol and ground it into powder and made him drink it. Okay, actually, it's a different story. I wish it said that. It doesn't. We don't know the resolution here, but it caused others to be led astray. We can do the same things in our life, whether it's us or the people we love, people we know. Secondly, churches can do this exact same thing. Not just individual Christians. Churches can certainly make a golden object that draws people's attention. Come here to our church. This is who we are. Look at how awesome this thing is. Come here for that. Instead of coming for God, instead of coming for worship, come here for that. The liberal churches are easy to pick on. They do this with sort of popular causes, you know, popular trends in the liberal cause, the Black Lives Matter type stuff, racial justice, sexual inclusivity, stuff like that. I bet you they started out thinking, you know what, we're Christians, we need to love people, let's make sure there's racial justice in our city. And I bet you they started off as a good thing there until it flipped. I bet you with the inclusivity of people of same-sex attraction and other things, I bet you that started off as a good thing and then it flipped. Okay. Churches do this with other things. Conservative churches aren't off the hook. Okay. Some traditional churches will say, we still sing hymns. Come enjoy worship with us and you can sing old-fashioned hymns. Okay, and that's great if that's what you want and that's what you're into. but you're here to worship God, not the music that you're singing. And you could fill in the blank with other stuff. I remember a pastor from Texas. He gained some popularity. His church kind of blew up and had, you know, thousands of people, multiple campuses, and all the rest. After enough time had passed, I think he realized he was the golden ephod, and he had to dismantle it all. Let's get back to being a church of people who actually meet in person, face to face. Let's not make me be, you know, the spectacle that everybody wants to come see. You can laugh at my jokes. You can enjoy the things I have to say. It can become a barrier. Things like this. Okay, and the important thing is if we create these things, we need to identify them, and we need to get back to worshiping God. We have to remove these barriers. Okay, so Gideon does this thing. Again, we'll call it his big mistake. If you want to be hard on him, Jesus says, if you cause even one of these little ones to stumble, you should have a millstone tied around your neck and thrown into the sea. I don't know. I don't think that was Gideon's heart here. I don't think that's what he was aiming for, and yet he did lead people astray. He'll be accountable to God for all this, okay, in the end. And we'll come back to this idea in a second, too. Let's finish up the chapter. Then Gideon, verse 29, son of Joash returned home. He had 70 sons born to him, for he had many wives. He also had a concubine in Shechem who gave birth to a son whom he named Abimelech. Gideon died when he was very old. He was buried in the grave of his father, Joash, at Ophrah, in the land of the clan of Abiezer. As soon as Gideon died, the Israelites prostituted themselves by worshiping the images of Baal, making Baal-berith their god. They forgot about the Lord their God, who had rescued them from all their enemies surrounding them. Nor did they show any loyalty to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, despite all the good he had done for Israel. Okay, so this is the end of Gideon's life. He said he didn't want to be king. He collects the tribute, makes the golden ephod, and then he goes on to live out his days, something like 40 more years, where he marries a bunch of women, has 70 kids. And probably the most condemning piece of evidence here is he names one of them Abimelech. Okay, and names back then actually mattered. He got renamed Jerubbaal, which is like Baal killer, because at the beginning of Gideon's ministry, he knocked down the idol of Baal, so they called him, well, he's the Baal killer. So they gave him this cool nickname. He names one of his sons Abimelech, and it has meaning, and it means my father is king. He says, I don't want to be king, but he names one of his sons, my father is king. He lives the life of a king. If you read the rest of the Old Testament, this is what all the kings did. Married a bunch of women, had a bunch of mistresses, had a bunch of kids, and they just lived in this way. This doesn't condone this. The Bible does not condone polygamy. It's just the way that they did it. It's reporting on how it went for them. So whether he wanted to be king or not, he ended up living like one. And this is hypocrisy. This is Gideon saying one thing and doing the opposite. But this goes back to the turning that went on in his life where he was following God, doing God's plan. At some point in time, he just said, I got this. I'm going to make my own choices from now on. It included the ephod. It includes living this life like a king. Okay. And all this goes really bad for everybody. He had led them out of idolatry originally. He had rescued them from these guys. The Midianites were basically bullies. Okay, they didn't rule over the Israelites, but they basically invaded whenever they wanted and stole their lunch money and stole their milk and stuff like that. He freed them from that. He gave them some form of peace for 40 years, but then he leads them back into this version of idolatry, okay, with the ephod. They were so spiritually weak by the time Gideon dies, they're just ready to go back to the old idol. The things that their fathers had left behind, the Baals, things that they weren't supposed to be doing, their faith in God was so weak that it says they just forgot about him. And they went back to where they came from. And so the cycle repeats. And this is the book of Judges. This is what happens over and over again. Okay? They get somebody to come in, raise them up, lead them forward, only to see it all fall apart again. The resolution here with Gideon is that he's part of the problem. And for all the good that he did, he still put them in a state where they were on the fringe, ready to fall. And then we see that they did here at the end. Now, one last point here. We can also make modern day Abimelechs. Okay, just like we can do ephods, we can do Abimelechs just the same. This would be the evidence of our own hypocrisy. Remember, Gideon said, I don't want to be king, names his son Abimelech. I see through that, and I hope you do too. There's ways that we can do this in our own life. We say, Jesus is Lord. And then with our living, even maybe with the things we say, the attitudes we have, we can prove, we have evidence that maybe that's not so true. Now with Gideon, in this case, I don't think the hypocrisy, I don't think it's meant to condemn him, as in he's out of God's kingdom, the rest of his life was a wash, all the good things he did prior are tainted, so we just need to think negatively of it, because that's not how the Bible treats him. Okay, the last word of the chapter here is, nor did they show any loyalty to the family of Jerubbaal, Gideon, despite all the good that he did for Israel. It's honest about the bad that he does, the hypocrisy, saying one thing, doing another, okay, dishonoring God with his lifestyle and behavior, even though he said he was going to be ruled by God. The last word of our chapter, it says, for all the good that he did. The Bible is honest about Gideon, but it's not overly critical. I think we can learn from his mistakes. I think we can learn from what he did so we don't repeat these things. It's not condoning them, that's for sure. It's just talking about how messed up things were at the time. But the actual final word on Gideon comes in the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 11. Okay, so let's turn there for just a second. So when we say Gideon is a hypocrite, again, hypocrisy is wrong. It's a sin. Jesus has an awful lot to say about it. It's not okay to be a hypocrite. This is not meant to say anything to the contrary. And yet, how Gideon's remembered is not for the hypocrisy. Okay, Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 32. How much more do I need to say? It would take too long to recount the stories of the faith of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets. By faith, these people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, received what God had promised them. They shut the mouths of lions, quenched the flames of fire, and escaped death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned to strength. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Okay, it goes on from there. These are imperfect people that God was willing to use. Their hypocrisy doesn't say that they were good and everything they did was right. It points to how God will use people who are imperfect. People who, even though they have shortcomings and inconsistencies, who have tremendous failures and flaws, that God will still use them. This actually highlights God's goodness, how good he is to work with us, even though we're sinful. I believe these stories of people like Gideon and Samson and all the rest, this actually helps us be more relatable to the grace of God, to who he's willing to love, to who he's willing to work with. We're far more like Gideon than we are like Jesus. Okay? We're far more like Gideon than we are like somebody who's close to perfection and God's doing great things with them. Think about the apostles for a second. Their flaws and faults, Peter, even Paul, they're mentioned in the New Testament. We're told the things that Peter does wrong. He puts his foot in his mouth over and over again, and God uses him. Even Paul, I just finished reading the end of the book of Acts. He does some things at the end that you're just like, I don't know, man. I don't know. God used him. God uses imperfect people. God loves us. God's patient with us. It wouldn't really be grace if we were perfect, and that's why God used us, would it? Wouldn't be a gift. It would be earned. And so God's willing to use us, even through our imperfection. That's what we see in Gideon here. So Gideon the hypocrite, yeah. Ben the hypocrite, yeah. The important thing is that we don't let this be the pattern of life. Hypocrisy to condemnation in the New Testament is the Pharisees. is Jesus telling them, you pretend to be religious, you pretend to be in love with God, but you're not. He says, hypocrisy is your lips are close to me, but your heart is far from me. You honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. That's the kind of hypocrisy that proves that there's no real faith. Inconsistency is a little different story. Again, I'm not condoning this. We can learn from Gideon, but I'm not going to condone the weird things that he did. Don't make an ephod. Okay, don't name your son Abimelech. But we can learn from this. And part of what we can learn is that God is good, and he's willing to work with us, even if we're inconsistent. Okay, even if we're going to fall short from time to time. Even if we're going to let our anger well up till we go out into the woods and find some, poison ivy and rub it in the faces of our enemies. That could have been what happened. God's good, even when we do those stupid things.